Hi, everybody. I'm Paul Yeager. This is the MTOM podcast from Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. I'm going to dial up an old friend or guy who's known me for pretty much my whole life. We grew up on the same gravel road just a few miles apart. He just has a couple of years older on me. But Ben Renshie is our guest. Benjamin is what he uses on his login screen for when we recorded this interview. So for the sake of, he's always been Ben to me. We're going to discuss the way things were in his part of the world versus the way my part of the world was, at least on the two different farms, and just how just a small little narrow strip of land can make a difference in a good crop, an average crop, or below average. We're going to talk about expectations. We're then going to get into finance. Ben's an old banker, been around the world as a banker. We discuss, his view of spreadsheets and what he sees. We are going to get into land. We're going to talk about iron, both new and used. We'll discuss many other things that are of interest to many of you, and I hope you find it as well here. We're also going to talk about an old friend of this program and that Ben and I both share in Bill Northey. We'll discuss him. And we'll just, you never know what else we're going to come up. And we will ask that question, does this look a lot like a certain decade that starts with an 8 and ends in 80s? If you have any feedback for me, send me an email at paul.yeager, Y-E-A-G-E-R, at iowapbs.org. New episodes of this podcast come out each and every Tuesday in both audio and video form. Let's talk farming now in 2023, before and in the future with Benjamin Renshie. If I listen closely, Ben, I'm hearing tractors out there. Is this early March where you're actually running out to the field with something?
This is the first time ever, Paul. I mean, to have tractors in the field, we see some anhydrous ammonia going on, some limited tillage. Totally unprecedented to have this sort of mild winter.
I had a neighbor of yours over in the Dyke area, so I guess on the other side of the county, sent me a picture in late February throwing anhydrous on over there. You ever seen that?
No, first time ever. And, you know, it's not exactly just this past little snip of weather. My corner of northeast Iowa, if you draw a line straight west of Chicago and straight south of Minneapolis, you'd be at my farm. And the Iowa State climatologist said that our area for the past three growing seasons is 50 inches behind on rain for the three seasons. Last year, we had 8 inches of rain from planting till harvest. And unlike the rest of the pack, Paul, I can't say my crops were better than expected. Mine were worse than expected.
I follow closely when you post weather reports because, as we've discussed before, I grew up on the same road you did, just a few miles apart. But mom's the home place did have some rain that you didn't. Does that's the ultimate farmer frustration, isn't it? When 2 miles down the road gets something, or half a mile down the road gets something, and you're shut out.
Well, we've always felt the Yeagers were on the good side of fortune, but yeah, that happens. And as farms have larger and larger footprints, which they do, you're going to have different results, but over our whole growing area, over a wide spot in northeast Iowa, we had much reduced crops. And I'll challenge what we've seen in the Nass County yields that were recently distributed. I think that I'm looking forward to the RMA information that comes out in June. And I know a lot of farmers took the ECO, SCO sort of crop insurance options, and they're looking forward to a very generous payment. I think that'll provide some clarity to what the actual crop size was.
Do you get the sense that the crop, the broad strokes that a government report gives, but yet the county report is still too broad, that doesn't do you justice when, say, someone is shut out of rain and only has 8 inches over 3 years?
Absolutely, Paul. I think that their survey methods are probably time to be updated. I've had almost invariably every year I have one field singled out, and the small plot, the NAS USDA survey. Of course, those people are making best efforts, but gosh, we have so many new digital tools, and the crop insurance system has expanded so much that there's a lot of other reliable information. I'm sure they're working to put it in, but you know, a farmer survey, everybody is honest and square on that, and nobody would ever put down the bins are emptier to see the market go up, or a livestock feeder the other way, that there's plenty out there, so we can have cheaper feed, which our hog producers have needed for a long time here. But then, you know, this sample of a very small area is, you know, like the seven blind men and the elephant parable. So, you know, you can find about whatever you want in the field. It's almost like people selling magic potions for crops. You just go out and pull the plant with big roots and little roots and say one had the magic potion and the other didn't. You know,
so buy here, here's where you sign.
Right. Yeah, I can find anything you want on my yield map. There's some place the monitor said it was 300 bushel and some place it said it was 100. Let's just go with the field average when we're done.
As a guy with a penchant for numbers, I mean, you're an old banker. You know how banking's not statistics, but numbers, we always talk about numbers will tell you anything you want, will justify anything you want. So when you look at the price on the board of trade today as we speak, and you know what you have or don't have, how do you market around something like that? And especially when a narrative gets told on certain programs over and over that the crop is this and the price is this, but I'm down here.
Paul, you could sell a little every week and probably get the average price for the year. So if you found yourself in the bottom half, who do you have to blame? It brings up a good point that that I've observed in the crop markets, in that so many trades are now put on with machine learning. You know, a human isn't even involved. I think I've heard statistics over 9 out of 10 trades on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange are put on by intelligence. And, you know, computers have been around for decades now, and cheap computing has made going through old tapes of prices and finding trading rules that work, like buy on early in the week, sell later in the week, and you make a consistent profit. But now the software has it so that you can make that better and change the rules. You know, it's not fixed, and you don't just trade the rule until it's gone. It updates every day how to make the rules better. And I've heard more than one market analyst say, and I might buy into this, that markets get accentuated up and down too far because of momentum trading in the markets. So what would be my advice? Find someone who understands this. And I always have a few advisors that I subscribe to keep me from getting entrenched in my thinking. Find someone who's dealt with this and seek the other opinions. Personally, I feel that we've probably overdone it to the bottom side, but then I'm sitting in an extremely dry area of the country. We've already talked about statistical yields from USDA NAS, and I feel that they're probably a bit overstated at this moment. There'll be future corrections for my area. And gosh, the market's been going down from the rallies last summer. So I'm the worst guy to talk to about, you know, whether people can all get on the wrong side of the boat.
We talk about the boat. I bring that question up of, you know, because John Roach always says it, you know, if everybody's on one side of the boat, maybe you need to get to the other side. Now, 2 weeks ago, Naomi Bloom said, we're quietly starting to see some movement in, I think it was wheat is what she was referring to, and slowly trying to move. Maybe the computer doesn't pick that up. When you say the percentage of these trades with AI, how do you, as a human, I mean, yes, you talk about multi different advisors and thinking, but it's hard for the average producer who has the product to be smarter than the computer, right?
Yes, and you can certainly position yourself so you have to pay a lot of margin calls or option premium on a crop you haven't produced yet. That is enormously unpopular with your banker. I can tell you that from experience, having to margin a crop you haven't grown yet. Paul, I don't have any answers from you, but I like to spread out. I like to spread out marketing, and I like to spread out the advisors I listen to. And not to be patronizing, but you bring some good ones to the table on your show.
Well, I got into it on Twitter here a couple of days ago about, you know, well, you should have these people on. And I'm like, I think we have a roster of 12 to 13 right now that rotate through. And yeah, not all are sunshine. There are a few bears. And I think that's, it's irresponsible if we just always blow sunshine. And I'm not here, we're not trying to say something, but there's realistic discussions. And again, every operation is different. The Renchi farm is different than the Jaeger farm, but we're only 4 to 6 miles apart. And that's hard for a large market to comprehend, I think, on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I just need an amen. That's all I need, Ben. Just an amen.
You're preaching to the choir,
Paul.
Okay.
All right. Let's talk about preaching with your banker. Conversations. What are you hearing from bankers? I mean, you absolutely have insight on that. We just had a land sale last week in Northwest Iowa go for nearly $30,000 an acre. Now, that's a little different than where you're at in the sense that's a lot of land that needs somewhere for manure to go. It's not quite the same for you. Are the land sales around you still going for primo pricing?
Yes. Right now, land is at a price that shouldn't be supported with the interest rate rises that we've had, with the prices of commodities. There's probably some, as Alan Greenspan would say, irrational exuberance in the land market, and there's probably something to come out of it. If we are, what I can comment on this, Paul, is the bankers and financiers I work with and keep in correspondence with said that there has been a startling drop in working capital on the farmer's balance sheet in the past year. We put in a very expensive crop last year. Equipment prices have doubled in 5 years, not always accompanied with productivity increases that would cover those price increases. And things have just, you know, we've taken the crop markets of 2021 and 2022 and extrapolated them well into the future, like they were going to stay with wide margins like that. Fertilizer prices just 12 and 24 months ago were back to all-time highs, and we put in a very expensive crop, and it hasn't been worth a lot of money, and I'm sure you can find a lot of people said they got it all sold before it went down, and that's just a bald-faced lie. You know, when farmer liquidity dries up, everything else follows, and I think you're already seeing it in the used equipment market, in the late model used equipment market. You're seeing, you know, that we've gone from kind of, if you want a new tractor, a new combine or sprayer, you can get on the wait list and you might see it in a year and a half and we won't fix the price, to a panic call that dealers have moved too many used buyers to new buyers. They've got a substantial number of people who trade a lot of the fleet every year as a way to manage repair costs. They're getting these late model trades in. My farm particularly uses a lot of the year-old equipment and runs it a few seasons. And the prices on those things have come down. And another thing that's affected that is the auction market. You know, the digitization of everything has that a lot of used equipment sells on the digital platforms now. And it makes some sense. The used market, the person who buys your used equipment isn't necessarily the vendor that sells you the new machine. And you might want to trade colors. You know, you might want to get a different color machine. And so the dealer for the new machine may not be the best for your used trade-in. And you're watching these things get sold and prices are off 25, 30% from a year ago on one-year-old sort of farm equipment.
Do you find that people are willing to go farther to find that used equipment because of the digitalization?
Oh, absolutely. We're replacing a combine, and we will have bidders on it from across the United States. And we've shipped equipment to Mexico. We've shipped equipment halfway across the country. And you know, look how people do, you know, the old days of going to a farm sale and having a nice made right sandwich made by the local church ladies and having a social day are kind of gone. You're kind of going to, you know, fire up the iPad and put your best bid out there and see if you got it. And click here for financing, click here for shipping. And we go there to look for better values on used equipment. And that's how we dispose a lot of our used equipment now.
Do you, what do you, is the used market, I won't say easier, not easier, that's the digitalization of it, but is it more prevalent than it has been in the last 5 years?
Oh, it's exponentially grown. I, you know, 3X, 5X, 10X. Yeah, it's somewhere in there.
So let's go back then 10 years. Let's go back to the great recession or even the 80s. I mean, used equipment. Are we seeing as much traffic in used iron as we did then, anecdotally?
I'm going to start singing Rain on the Scarecrow, you know, Blood on the Plow here, Paul. Those were different times. But yeah, the digital platform is kind of the new farm sale. So
we're still moving equipment and people are still buying it. I mean, when you're saying that these dealers were pushing people to new, have some of those that went new who can't afford it to stay in that game have gone back to used?
Yes. Yes, it has. And we experienced that. You know, we all try our best shot. For my frontline farm equipment, I want to keep that pretty crisp and fresh. We had a articulated four-wheel drive tractor, 4,000 hours on it, by no means wore out. You can run them a lot longer than that, but they're probably going to take some repairs, and this is something that has to run so our planters can run right behind it. So we wanted something, you know, a little more frontline. We bought a one-year-old tractor for $100,000 less than dealer asking, and we turned around, and I felt we got full value out of our $4,000 tractor. So, you know, that's the way we're you know, putting the spin on the ball this year.
Are you finding that, like, the anecdotes I hear on this land and the why it's so high is because there's still farmers able to pay cash. Are there still farmers able to pay cash on machinery too? Or is it all financing?
I disagree. I think that there's financing somewhere. It may not be that piece of equipment is financed, but for the person who bought my tractor, used tractor for $225,000, I'm going to guess that their line of credit's got extra balance on it this year.
We're paying more attention to what the banker says. We're having more conversations. Land is high. Interest is high. Equipment's high. You mentioned a John Cougar Mellencamp song from the 80s. Dare I ask it, does this remind you of any time in history?
The whole system is more transparent now. We fix our problems earlier and sooner, and those people that have survived probably. I got my cash flow done weeks and weeks earlier than usual this year because I didn't want an uncomfortable moment with my financiers, and I thought this may create opportunity. But I like to play offense on my farm. We're a growing, expanding farm, and I have young people. I've got a son and son-in-law that farm, and so we're always planning to try and do more. So that there's a spot for those young men and their families. And it reminds me of the 80s. It's not going to, you know, history always rhymes, never repeats itself. What we had in the 80s, you had a farm policy that had a whole extra crop in the bin by 1985, 1986, and $1 corn. We have much less surplus than that now. We actually had government farm programs that paid us to continue to produce then. We had a farm programs that paid us to store it and tuck that away, which capped any rally potential we ever had because you just go to the bin and get a load out and reward the rally, and the rally was gone. We do not have the extreme interest rates, but I would factor that capital assets have gone up, equipment and land so much that rather than just experiencing it in the finance cost, the actual production cost has gone up so much that maybe is a little bit closer. And look at in those days, livestock manure was a bigger percentage of the fertilizer. We didn't use as much chemistry, it wasn't as effective and useful as it is today. It replaces, look at all the ag chemistry herbicides that replace tillage and cultivation during the year. You need a lot of cash to grow today's crop. And the way we micromanage it with precision applied fertilizer and prescriptive nutrients, it just takes a lot more capital. It takes a lot more inputs. It's a different kind of agriculture today, Paul. But it rhymes. It rhymes.
Do you think that the renewable side of this equation has helped stabilize some of these discussions because it's another outlet for income and for a market?
That's an interesting discussion, especially as I don't think every farmer has it on the front of their radar of this 45Z tax credits that come in the Inflation Reduction Act. But the fact that the renewable fuels business could pay farmers more for sustainably raised crops, and this is all subject to definition, it has real power for rural America and food security and rural development. I mean, if we're going to have a safe and ample food supply, you need a thriving rural America. And the tax credits could provide us a lot of, if they get to the farmer's gate, if the greedy grain merchandisers don't all keep it for themselves. I had to say it that way.
That's good. I like that. Nice and subtle.
Yeah. Well, honestly, the grain trade looks at the credits and says, gee, how do I buy the grain? And if I don't have the data-enriched bushels that it will take to qualify for the 45Z money, how do I discount the other grain that doesn't have it? Well, the farmer's position is, how do I get part of the premium? And, there's estimates up to above $1 a bushel on corn that you could bank. So we're working this all out, and farmers need to be part of the discussion. I don't have all the answers on how to do that, but the more farmers in the discussion, someone a lot more clever than I will come up with the answer.
And they're working on answers to, E15 year-round. And I had a discussion with someone a couple of weeks ago kind of wanting a little explanation about ethanol. And I said, the ethanol's been good, but it's still the DDG. You talked about the livestock manure and how we fed that. Now, we don't feed the manure, but we feed the DDGs to the livestock. I mean, all these things have kind of had different inputs and outputs. And so it's not chemistry. I guess it's more of a math equation than it is science right now. But I would like to think that the renewables have been beneficial for rural America. Is that fair to say that's true?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to be in the Mississippi Delta. I have some business down there. And I think about what happened in cotton country when everything mechanized 80 years ago. And, there's a significant instance of poverty down there, and they've never quite had the redevelopment that they'd like to have down there. And it's because rural agriculture, rural American agriculture had a huge change in what they could offer the people that lived in the region. Not that picking cotton by hand was good business, but it did keep a lot of people fed and alive and, kept a lot of small rural America vibrant and prosperous. And you wonder about that with renewable fuels. Having ethanol plants nearby keeps livestock in the area, keeps people busy, keeps dealers running with trucks and tractors and keeps people active in their schools and rural institutions, churches. It's wonderful. So don't overlook the value of renewable energy on keeping rural America vibrant, which is something I think most of people who watch this podcast would agree it'd be positive.
And it goes beyond just what's at the gas pump. I mean, there's so much more to it, but sometimes it gets too simplified for a group of people that it's just about, you can buy that at the pump. It's a whole bigger deal than that. Tax benefits that you were kind of dancing around there a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, you need to keep your tax base up, and that's what keeps our roads and schools and the traditional infrastructure prosperous, advancing. Yes.
Let's get to carbon for a minute, if I could, because that's another promise being made to some areas where a pipeline might go through and areas that would benefit because of those pipelines. What's the carbon discussion like in the world of Benjamin Renzi right now?
It would be great to have a revenue source that rewarded you for something other than yield. Right now, we still sell bulk commodities off most of our farms or livestock that just has its normal value in the production chain. Carbon allows farmers to get rewarded for the way they do it. And so I'm very pro, you know, the establishment of a carbon market. It's a very challenging subject to have the education out there about how we raise our crops. All you have to do is watch all the late night ambulance chasing lawyers talk about, pesticide injury judgments and things like that. But we need tools in our toolbox to raise our crops effectively. It'd be great if we could raise all our crops without herbicide, but that's just not the reality. Until we figure out the next system, we need tools in our toolbox. And we need Washington to support us on that. And I think you know where I'm leading on this. Things like the Endangered Species Act are not presently helping us. There's been a great resignation in Washington during the pandemic, and places like the EPA need more people. And you're not going to believe a farmer saying this, but they actually need some money to attract people into jobs. They might need to go to more of a hub and spoke model because it's easy to get weed scientists at a land-grant university, but it's tougher to get them to move to Washington, D.C. And so maybe some of the things we've learned, we can get great scientific talent, keep tools in the farmer's toolbox, like herbicides, fungicides, pesticides. There's a whole layer of things being debated in Washington, pesticide use licensing areas, and like I said, the Endangered Species Act, and they shortcut to get us keep these tools in our toolbox. They rule out counties that have lesser use or areas that might not use them. And heaven forbid, the worst thing that can happen is we start legislating county by county by county without the scientific background and don't make the best judgments for farmers to stay prosperous and keep the food supply ample and keep us with minimal chances of food insecurity.
It almost sounds like the beginning of our conversation when we talked about weather being too broad of a brush, that Blackhawk County was terrible or was great, when in reality, your neighborhood of Blackhawk County was not so great. Funny how those all go back together, right?
Yeah. All politics is local, Paul.
Nope, I can't answer that one right now. I'll get myself in trouble. Land, state. I asked you about historic. I've asked you about, you talked about some tax credits. One last thing I want to close with here is that your work with the Farm Foundation, twofold. You had a meeting recently, and it was with a mutual friend of ours who was a good friend to a lot in agriculture, and Bill Northey. What was your first interaction with Bill?
Oh, my first, very first. Bill was first running for Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, and I went to a fundraiser for him. And I thought, this is a guy who's a leader for agriculture. He advocated well. And once I, and that kind of resonated with me. Then I was on a laboratory. I was at Corteva in Des Moines, and they had invited me in with other farmers as a client to see their facilities and things like that, and they invited Bill in. And this was during the first round of bird flu, of avian flu. And it struck me, Bill came in, and I was expecting him to just talk about the farmer's viewpoint. Bill came in, and he talked about how this affected the consumer And that was the moment, that was the epiphany I had, that this guy is looking out for me and was a real leader and did a wonderful job. And it is a traumatic loss to have lost Bill, because he was such an advocate for us. He loved the Iowa farmer. He loved the American farmer. And he worked as hard as possible to make sure. I got to tell you this. When you have semi-trucks on a farm, you can reduce your cost of licensing by just having a farm special plate that says that you will just truck for your farm. As trucks got bigger, tri-axle semis or seven-axle trucks, we call them, had not made it into the provisions of this. I was invited. I was in Washington, D.C. I brought it up with Bill. You know, here he is, Undersecretary of Agriculture. But no, Bill calls back to Iowa and does the groundwork to get seven-axle trucks with farm special plates and save every farmer a couple $1,000s a year. That's the kind of guy he was. He was always worried about us, always looking out for us. I'm sorry, Paul.
It actually reiterates what I was going to ask. It enforces it. His time, we had my last conversation with him was after his time in D.C. And he did both enhance his view of the Iowa farmer, but also learned other ways to skin the cat, I guess, if you will, from other parts of the country, and just how agriculture is different across the United States and not just necessarily in Iowa. But he kind of wanted to make both better. And that's what always struck me is, again, agriculture was first for him. It didn't quite matter if it was his home state or maybe another state. It was just making everybody better. That was my take of it.
So mid-January at the Farm Foundation meeting, the Farm Foundation always visits agricultural interests, and we visited a macadamia nut farm. And mid-January, I was snacking on macadamia nuts with Bill and telling a few jokes and introducing him around. I introduced him to an entrepreneur who's got an exciting new technology in soybean genetics, and he was excited about how this could be used. And then I went to the Iowa Power Farming Show in Des Moines, ran into Bill, and just by the escalators in Hy-Vee Hall, happenstance, ran into Bill, and he pulled me aside, and he said, "Say, your son Hans is going to go on a Nuffeld scholarship, and he's going to go tour farms all over the world for most of a year." And I'm like, "How do you know this, Bill?" But he's like, "This is wonderful. He's going to find out about agriculture everywhere and bring it back here and share what Iowa agriculture is all about." Anyway, that's just signature Bill, thinking about how to make farming better.
Do you think you're going to have a better year? How are you going to have a better year in 2024 on your farm?
I'm buying up more crop insurance because it hasn't started raining.
What do you mean? I saw the radar Monday go right through your place.
Yeah, that 0.07 of an inch was a drought buster, Paul, you know. It almost settled the dust between me, my office and my house. But things better change fast or it's going to be rinse and repeat this year. And, you know, you think back, what was it like? You know, you've asked me some questions in this interview about what it was like in the 80s. And I think, what was it like in the 30s? You know, you hear Dust Bowl days, tales 36, 37, 38. You hear about huge blizzards, but then it didn't rain all summer and it got hot endlessly. And you just wonder if we're in one of these apocalyptic, near biblical sort of times that we're just got a 3-year bum spot in Northeast Iowa. I think that's probably the case.
We're going to find out. There's not much we can do.
We're not going to spend as much money on equipment, yeah, that's for sure. The banker said, none of that.
That could be the first domino. We'll see. Weather's been, maybe weather's the first, the banker's the second. We'll see what the third is, and we'll discuss it from there. Ben Renchie, good to see you. Thank you so much for the time.
Pleasure talking to you, Paul. Take care.
If you have feedback for the general program of Market to Market, send it in an email to markettomarket@iowapbs.org. Like, subscribe, follow, do whatever you want to with this podcast. We really like it when you share. Thank you for watching, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.